Okay, I'm John Beck, and together with my colleague Kurt Dewhurst, I co-direct Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives. And thank you all for coming out on this extremely cold day. The nice thing is it's warmer in here than it is out there, so it's not a bad place to take refuge for a while and hear a great presentation as you're about to hear. But before we get to that presentation, I just have a few quick announcements to make, and then we'll get going. A week from today in the series, we have kind of, it's an interesting presentation. It's called The Centerpieces in the People's Party, Creating a Workplace Holiday Tradition. The Michigan Historical Center downtown has had an annual kind of Christmas tradition that's included their version of the Capitol Steps, a group that actually write parody songs and perform them then during the holidays, often about things going on in state government. So they're gonna come next week, the centerpieces are, along with other folks, to talk about how this tradition started. And it actually started because they were told that they couldn't do it. So that's part of kind of the interesting story. So I think it'll be musical, it'll be funny, I think it'll be entertaining. And it's really about kind of the kinds of things that we create in workplaces that are the heart many times of workplace culture that become traditions and become talked about and are passed on to each new generation of workers in the workplace. So let me just hand that flyer back and people can take one if they want to and keep on passing them around. The rest of the series this spring is just sparkling, so I'll send that around. We do love to have you here, and we have one coming up. John McCutcheon is a wonderful performer who's going to be next month. One of our dates is going to be over at the MSU Library. So we want to mention that to you. The Wanamaker Collection is a collection of photographs of Native Americans, and we currently have an exhibit on the ground floor here in honor of Susan Krause, who was a museum colleague in the anthropology department who tragically passed away a bit back. And so I think it's perfectly in line with a lot of the stuff that Dr. Morgan is going to be talking about today. Now, coming soon to the main floor here, it's like, doesn't that sound like a Vegas thing? Coming soon to our main floor is an exhibit called On Equal Terms. And On Equal Terms is a mixed media exhibit on women in construction. And it was put together by a poet, a blogger, artist, and journeyman electrician, or journeywoman electrician, Susan Eisenberg. If any of you come out of kind of a poetry background, she was one of Denise Levertov's students. Denise Levertov is probably one of the best known 20th century American poets. And Susan is a wonderful poet, so she's going to be doing a poetry reading at Creole Gallery while she's installing the installation. And then we're opening it up on February 5th, so the poetry reading's on February 1st. The opening itself is Sunday, February 5th. And she's doing a brown bag in our series about On Equal Terms and about the experience of women in construction and skilled trades. So I really commend all of that to you, so I'll pass those around. Everybody always should walk away with handouts here. If you don't, we haven't done our job. So let me now introduce Dr. Mindy Morgan, who's with the MSU Department of Anthropology. Mindy is, besides being a professor over there, is also associate chair, so she's kind of, you know, juggling both administrative responsibility as well as teaching and research responsibility. Mindy and I started talking about this specific talk. I was really saying to her, you know, is there anything you're working on? And then she told me about this project. Indians at Work, as she'll tell you, was a periodical that really had the power through kind of a vision and the photograph of being able to tell a different story. Now, it's always true that photographs tell stories, and she's going to tell us about this specific group of photographs in this specific periodical. The name of her talk is Visions and Visages, Transforming Images of American Indians and Indians at Work, 1933 through 1945. So please help me in welcoming Dr. Mindy Morgan.
Thank you very much. I really do appreciate the chance to be here and to talk to you today. And I will give, I'll have to apologize in advance. I'm going to kind of read a little bit of the paper and then hopefully talk a little bit about, a little bit more extemporaneously as well. I want to talk just for a moment, and one of the things that that John said when we first started talking, I am a linguistic anthropologist, and I work primarily with American Indian communities and issues of language, indigenous language revitalization and maintenance. However, the talk that I'm giving today is not that. And so I'm wondering, like, oh, you know, in the workplace and things like that. And I said, well, I actually am working on another project, one that's more ethno-historical that has to do with the periodical Indians at Work. And so this is a new area and a new project for me. I'm still interested in some of the same things that motivates my work with indigenous languages, and that is these moments of tension in particular spaces between how do you articulate, how you talk about certain sorts of experiences, especially when you have kind of different epistemologies coming together. And the same thing that I see in the indigenous language classroom, which is a lot of my work has been on, you also see in the pages of Indians at Work, which is this strange, complicated pastiche, which might come out a little bit in the talk today. Before I go into the actual talk, I do want to say just a little bit about some images. This is been kind of ruminating on for a while, but have only recently started doing some research for. So it still is at the preliminary stages. And I hope to have a chance, if you have questions or suggestions, I'd love to hear any of them. The images that you will see is something about Indians at Work that I didn't put into the talk. The periodical itself, as you can see from the title, actually ran from 1933 to 1945, was primarily the work of John Collier, who was the Commissioner of Indian Affairs during this time, the very powerful Commissioner of Indian Affairs during this time. So it's a very long time span. It actually started off being published twice a month, and then in about 1937 went to a monthly. So that also means there's a lot. There are many, many issues of Indians at Work. A lot of different places, including MSU, have actually copies of Indians at Work, a lot of them in partial runs. There is a full and nearly complete, save for a few issues, down at University of Michigan in the Burr Library. And that's actually where I started. This project was actually going down there and looking at the full issue. Well, University of Michigan, because of partnership with Google, has actually recently in 2010, digitized the entire run of Indians at Work. So now it is actually accessible through our library, which is amazing. And so if you're, a lot of the images that I'm pulling down from, are they're the PDFs that come from that project. So it's also a very interesting sort of thing that I'm starting to deal with, which is that now this amount of material is easily accessible. It's right there. It's on my computer. But it's still so vast that it's hard to kind of start to kind of pull out exactly the kind of the key pieces and parts for analysis. But so that's just a little bit about the periodical itself and where it can be found. So if you're interested in it, it's there, it's online. And what's amazing to me is that if you talk to people who are involved in American Indian Studies, historians, anthropologists, various disciplines, art history, I think I saw it, yeah, most people know about the periodical Indians at Work. It was a very highly trafficked place. Pretty much anybody who's anybody ends up writing for and contributing to Indians at Work at some point during this period. Given that, it is really surprising. There is no scholarly work that looks at the periodical itself. It has been used. Pieces of it have been used and incorporated into scholarship, but there is nothing that looks at the periodical itself. And that's actually my larger project, and that's what I aim to do, is to really kind of start to understand where Indians at Work, where the periodical itself functioned, how it functioned, and kind of it, and its contributions. That's also to say there are many projects that various people, I think, this is a wonderful resource that I think has been underutilized. And I'm hoping that perhaps more people will start to realize the incredible amount of knowledge and interesting stuff that actually is in there. So with that very enormous preamble, I'm going to go to a little bit more of my scripted talk, but again, I'll hopefully be looking up a little bit more and being able to talk about some of these images, which I find truly amazing. So, Visions and Visages, Transforming Images of American Indians and Indians at Work. In his editorial to the second issue of Indians at Work, published in 1933, John Collier, the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, reflects on the role of the Indian Service in helping to facilitate the blending of what he perceives as the Indian and the modern world. He considers how the two seeming irreconcilable modes of living can be brought together by the, quote, Indian drawing on his own native deeps and, quote, a modernity drawing on its own native deeps. He doesn't really go on to that. It's a little bit peculiar. Then he finishes, the Indian Service must bring the Indian and the modern world together. But what Indian and what modern world? The question posed by Collier is illustrative of an ideology that not only locates indigenous peoples outside of modernity, but also in opposition to it. This ideology is not just a historical artifact of the 20th century. Strains of it can be seen through contemporary historiography as well. In fact, some scholars have argued that while modern U.S. history has expanded to include underrepresented populations, American Indians continue to be left out of these broader narratives as a result of the persistent idea that to become modern is to no longer be indigenous. An effect of this notion is the participation of American Indians in U.S. history beyond the late 19th century is largely invisible. Where they do appear, indigenous communities are treated as exceptional rather than exemplary of trends within the United States, and their impact has been confined to both specific arenas and locations. The fields of American Indian history and American Indian studies more broadly have produced important work regarding the experiences of indigenous communities throughout the 20th century, but they've not impacted dominant narratives of U.S. history in significant ways. And here are just a few kind of images from Indians at Work showing a little bit of this kind of complicated notions of what it meant to be American Indian in the 1930s. Today, I want to argue that the focus on reconciling the paradox of the indigenous and the modern that Collier himself kind of invokes has distracted scholars from critically assessing the role of American Indian communities in shaping contemporary U.S. history. It's also obscured the ways in which American Indian experiences have played pivotal roles in legal, environmental, and labor history, among others. And in fact, what I'd like to argue today is that this modern and indigenous paradox or divide largely focuses on labor, and thus both a connection to Indians at Work and a connection to the theme of this series, that what really kind of this tension between the indigenous and the modern really focuses on types of labor, places of labor, who does the laboring, men, women, gendered aspects of it. And today what I'd like to do is attempt to move American Indian communities towards the center of historical debates by looking specifically at their participation within the New Deal reforms in the mid-20th century. New Deal reforms were transformative for Native communities, and a large percentage of tribal members participated in the relief programs. Excuse me. Yeah.
Because of the acoustics
in here, oh, sorry. Slower? Sure. That's also my problem. I'll try, and please do.
I wasn't going to say anything, but you spread out.
No, absolutely, absolutely. Well, I was trying to get. I will try and look up, and I will. I have a tendency to talk very fast, so my students complain about this all the time. Now. Again, the thing that I find ironic about it, and even given Collier's opening quotation, is that the periodical Indians at Work, it belies the content of the very news sheet in which his letter appears. From 1933 to 45, the Office of Indian Affairs used this biweekly and later monthly news sheet to document and promote the various public works that both employed Native peoples and transformed the landscape of tribal communities. While an official publication of the Indian Office, contributors to Indians at Work range from local tribal members employed by conservation projects to anthropologists to government officials. In so doing, they documented and promoted a particular ways of being an Indian in the mid-20th century. The periodical was distributed nationally, and its readers, both Native and non-Native, were as diverse as its contributors. Both its frequency and duration make the periodical one of the most comprehensive descriptions of relief work in the 1930s, for any relief work, not just American Indian. Ultimately, I argue that Indians at Work needs to be taken seriously as an encapsulated history of not only emergency conservation work, but of the goals, impacts, and failures of the New Deal policies. So I'm going to start by talking a little bit about kind of the invisibility of American Indians in scholarship. And then I want to focus on Indians at Work and see how the periodical sought to simultaneously document participation while also containing and defining Native experiences, particularly through the photographs. And then finally, I consider how images used in the periodical illustrate the very contentious and contradictory ideas of both indigeneity and modernism. I'm just beginning this project, as I said, so my analysis is incomplete. But I want to talk about how Indians at Work is a productive site in which ideas and images of the quote-unquote modern Indian is debated, but ultimately that no one can deny the contribution of American Indians to relief programs as a whole. So scholars, particularly within American Indian Studies, have increasingly employed concepts of silencing and erasure in order to attend to the uneven distribution of power among participants and actors in the creation of historical narratives. This has been constructive when interrogating archival resources and documentary records that are largely products of a colonial administration and rarely offer a space for indigenous voices to emerge. As a result, scholars have critically engaged these sources and argued for the inclusion of other forms of evidence, such as material culture and oral history, to be used in writing indigenous histories. The case of American Indian participation in New Deal programs offers a different, yet equally compelling, dilemma. The intense bureaucratic nature of the programs in Roosevelt's quote-unquote alphabet soup means that there's an abundance of materials that exist in the archival record. Letters, reports from the field, and other documents detail events in triplicate. Rather than a paucity of sources, New Deal historians have had to manage overwhelming amounts of materials. As a result, many scholarly works that concern this time are focused on one particular aspect of the relief program. And so, especially when American Indians are concerned, erasure stems from, in some ways, a surplus of sources rather than a lack, but the result is still exclusion. This limited focus of scholarly work can be seen in American Indian Studies as well. There's an overwhelming amount of attention to the political restructuring of Native communities as a result of the Indian Reorganization Act, which was passed in 1935. But the Collier administration also pushed for economic relief and development through a number of federal programs that were established for the rest of the American population. So there was not this big divide between Indian and non-Indian relief. A separate division of the Civilian Conservation Corps, the CCCID, was established that concentrated on projects throughout the 1930s and early 1940s. This I should remember what my slides are. This is just a cover that I really like, but there's just kind of an example of what Indians at Work, the actual publication, looks like in a table of contents. And if you look at it closely, you can see that it covers a wide variety of issues, both pertaining to tribal communities themselves, but also then kind of larger issues that's happening in the country too. A separate Indian division of the Civilian Conservation Corps, the CCCID, was established that concentrated on projects to help maintain reservation lands, such as erosion control, forestation, and range management. And there were critical differences between the two divisions, the CCC and the CCCID. They were run out of separate departments, and enrollment requirements varied. And importantly, the members of the CCCID were not required to live in camps. That, of course, were the heart of the CCC. And a lot of the scholarly work that's done on the Civilian Conservation Corps kind of focuses on the camps. And I'm thinking particularly Neil Marr has a fairly new book that looks at kind of the environmental impact of the CCC, but focuses really on the camps themselves. The work, however, of the CCCID was the same. They did physically the same sort of work, and the impact on the surrounding environment was comparable. Despite the fact that over 85,000 tribal members took part in the program, their participation has hardly registered in secondary material related to the CCC. Similarly, American Indian participation in the Federal Writers Project has failed to garner attention. Elsewhere, I've written about how multiple projects initiated through state writers' projects offices that concerned American Indian communities have similarly have gone unnoticed in scholarly literature. Many projects were started but never published, and this has led to the erroneous conclusion that American Indian communities did not participate in these larger national projects, but they did. And the lack of attention is even more surprising given the fact that they are all documented in Indians at Work. So, Indians at Work, and this is the first... So this comes from Indians at Work, but this is all of the actual descriptions of the various works projects that are going on in all of the different reservation communities. Sometimes there are documentations about things that are happening off the reservation, but largely they focus on the reservation. And so every single issue concludes with about two or three pages of these just kind of paragraphs coming in about what the work is. So dam projects, forestation, management, everything gets documented in here. And I would argue that this is a great resource for people who are doing labor history, who are doing environmental history, and to my knowledge, I could be wrong, but to my knowledge, nobody's really looked at Indians at Work for this type of information. But it is there. Let's see, then my next, There we go. This is the first issue that was published in 1933. And it was initially described, as you can see there, a new sheet for ourselves. This overly reflexive title soon gave way to a new sheet for the Indians and the Indian Service. As I mentioned, it started as a biweekly publication but became a monthly publication in November of 1937. Tribal members were the primary audience for the periodical, and this is very important considering how, as I started, this discussion about, you know, what Indian and what modernism. The actual reading audience was intended to be Indians who themselves were participants in these projects. The tribal members were the primary audience, and it did serve as a way of informing and linking tribal communities together. However, government officials, employees of the Indian Service, and non-Native readers also subscribed. Issues always began with an editorial by Collier himself that commented on either current issues in the Indian Office or a reflective essay on the topics that were going to be covered in the rest of the periodical. It highlighted issues that were of critical importance to Collier himself, including educational reform and a focus on Indian arts, and there is quite a bit on Indian arts throughout the entire run. During the early years, Indians at Work also served as a vehicle for both promoting the Indian Reorganization Act. And so, for example, the issue published on January 1, 1935 has, which I find very interesting, it offers the results of the referendum vote on the IRA that occurred on December 15th. And just for people who don't know about the Indian Reorganization Act, so this was an opportunity for reservation communities to actually, if you had to vote to accept the Indian Reorganization Act. And I don't want to go off into a long description of it, but it was a way for tribal communities to actually, according to Collier, kind of go back to some sort of pre-reservation idealized notion of political governance. But it was a way for tribal communities to take control over the tribes themselves. They had to adopt a constitution, which, despite Collier wanting to go back to some pre-reservation ideal, the constitution was largely based on kind of Western notions of governance. But regardless, and then after tribes, they could either vote to accept it or not to accept it. Then oftentimes they could also become incorporated so they could have businesses and so on and so forth. What's interesting here is that he goes through and he talks about all of the different communities that have voted either yes or no. And if you hadn't voted or if you were voting no, you also became kind of the, it was a way of bringing attention. And so Collier kind of surveilling who was accepting and who was not accepting his. And again, remembering that American Indians were the primary reading audience of this too, it became a way of kind of surveilling, I would argue, a way of kind of surveilling them. It seems to be disseminating information, but it's also a way of the Indian Office kind of saying this is what you should be doing. Other articles demonstrate the breadth of the projects and chronicle the impact of the works, including field reports from individuals. Throughout the text, Collier's editorial control is extensive. He did solicit information from multiple sources, but he had the power of selection. Debates contentious at the time, such as erosion, irrigation, and livestock management, again, this especially among the Navajo community, the issue of livestock management under Collier was really disastrous. Curiously, that's absent from Indians at Work. Or not so curiously, it's absent from Indians at Work. The place where I work, do most of my field work, Fort Belknap Reservation, which is up in north central Montana, irrigation was a very, very large and contentious discussion. It also, you don't see a whole lot about irrigation. And then, of course, damming projects both in the northwest and then also up in the northern plains in the Missouri River area. Again, very contentious within communities, sometimes gets a little bit elided and absented from these discussions. But kind of for more of our discussion today, more importantly, Collier used the periodical, or not more importantly, additionally, Collier used the periodical to forward particular ways of both seeing and viewing American Indian communities, both by themselves and by the general public. Indians at Work focused on publishing, in many cases, republishing ethnographic works authored by anthropologists and other social scientists about indigenous communities. So in addition to documenting the current works, they were actually reprinting things from the Bureau of American Ethnology, other recently published ethnographies that dealt with Native communities, and to some degree, though not extensively, ethnographic works that were done on communities in South America. There was a few issues that kind of focused on Brazilian Indians in particular. Yeah, and also, of course, at the time, a lot of focus on Alaska and the Inuit communities up there as well. Collier himself was greatly influenced by anthropology, and he believed that the knowledge produced by the discipline could be used to shape responsible public policy. In 1935, Collier established the Applied Anthropology Unit and named Yale-trained anthropologist H. Scudder Meikle to head the new department. Anthropologists in the AAU served as field consultants to report on the impact of proposed changes of the IRA on tribes, as well as general reservation conditions. Indians at Work became the primary vehicle for both providing updates on the work of the unit, as well as a place for the publication of materials emanating from it. And anthropological discussions and ethnographic snapshots frequently appeared in the periodical. These range, as I said, from the Bureau of American Ethnology bulletins to previously published manuscripts from individuals such as Clark Whistler, John Harrington, and Ruth Benedict, who I have a picture of here, and a little selection from Indians at Work, The Broken Cup. In fact, actually, Patterns of Culture, which was published about the same time, was serialized in Indians at Work. So it becomes this very interesting sort of reflexive notion where American Indian communities are reading about Benedict's discussion of American Indian communities. So it becomes very kind of circular. Others were from those actively working within the Applied Anthropology Unit. Scudder Meikle, who you see up here as well, too, was a frequent contributor, as was Ruth Underhill. While scholars vacillated in both tone and scope, some took on the objective distance voice common to social science discourse at the time, while others, including Meikle himself, offered informal discussions of contemporary reservation life. Their contributions all reinforced Collier's own idea about the need to represent Native communities both to themselves as well as outsiders. And it's critically that this overtly referential function was not applied to other communities under the scope of New Deal programs. So this is something that is in some ways particular to Native communities. Because of this added function, it's important to note that within Indians at Work, there are many examples of vanishing, compliant, and noble Indians that were the dominant tropes at the time. This brings up a troubling question. If the Works projects as a whole were willing to embrace plurality and discuss difference among other American Indian or other American minority communities, why do these images in particular persist? And I would have to argue that on some level, administrators in the Indian Office knew that to directly address the complex social and economic status of tribal members in contemporary U.S. society at the time would quickly unearth troubling ideas for the larger American populace about a history of dispossession, broken treaties, and general failure toward indigenous communities. And it was easier, even in the pages of Indians at Work, to rely on romantic or scientific notions of the Indian rather than to deal with the diversity and complexity of Native America at the time. This complexity, however, cannot be erased, and one of the places that it's most visible is in the photographs that appear within the periodical. The pictures, including the cover photos, tell a story of their own about the admiring, both the admiring and ambivalent gaze of the federal government toward American Indian communities at the time. The photos throughout the periodical emphasize the transformation from tribal distinctions to a generalizable American Indian. This transformation is dramatically demonstrated in the changing cover designs at Indians at Work. And so what I have up here are just a few examples of some things I'm going to talk about in terms of cover designs. The first cover designs, which you'll see here on your left, were predominantly black and white illustrations that depicted a corporate tribal identity. Some of these covers were patterns that were found in local artistic traditions, such as pottery. And the top one is actually a Northwest Coast kind of design that was incorporated, while others were contemporary designs based on tribal motifs. And the one down here is a contemporary one that was done at the School of Art and Design in Santa Fe by actually Indian students. And what's interesting is that it really kind of created this synergy between federal programs that were directed at American Indian communities. So the school in Santa Fe would provide illustrations and stuff for Indians at Work. But despite whether they were kind of based on a tribal motif or kind of extrapolated for them, they were all evocative of some sort of tribal affiliation, creating and recreating a modern aesthetic that invoked a pre-contact organization and an orientation to the periodical. So I'd say from roughly 1933 to about 1936, 37, these were the dominant sort of cover designs. But it changed in the late 1930s, and here are some examples of some later ones here. Black and white photographs supplanted the black and white illustrations. Importantly, the subjects of these photographs were the participants in the programs and the location of Works projects. A survey of the cover photographs from roughly 1938 to 1940 shows the predominant theme of rural and environmental transformation. So it's less about being tribal and more about engaging in the work of transforming location. In these photographs, workers, when they are depicted, are usually just that, plural. They are represented as groups who are engaged in a common enterprise. And a real this one from May 1938 is a good example of that, where we have all of these men, and importantly, these largely are men, and they're workers. They're engaged in this. In this case, they're digging ditches in that particular photograph. And so they're represented as groups who are engaged in a common enterprise. Though most people can be read as phenotypically American Indian, and what's very interesting in these photographs as they go on, phenotype becomes very important to identify as Indian. It becomes the primary marker of Indianness, not design, not clothing. It's phenotype, so a biological sort of notion, which is something I'm still trying to kind of work out in my own brain. So they can be read phenotypically as American Indian, but they've lost their specific tribal identification. These photographs still strongly locate the workers in their environments, but outside readers unfamiliar with local topography would not necessarily be able to identify where in the country the group was actually working. There's an emphasis in these photos on shared labor, regardless of place, ultimately. So they become, in some ways, nondescript. By the 1940s, however, the cover photos were no longer about groups of laborers, but rather the individual laborer. As U.S. involvement in the war became imminent, these photos were often of individual tribal members who were service members, as you can see in the one on the right, or workers in wartime industries, as you can see in the worker on the left. Unlike the previous photographs that were almost exclusively set in rural locations, these cover shots included urban settings and particularly the factory. And you see the factory emerging again and again and again. Covers that continued to depict quote-unquote traditional Native culture prioritized individuals over groups and often were explicitly what I would call ethnographic, conjuring nostalgic ideas of Indianness that were in stark contrast to other images of engaged workers fulfilling important tasks. And again, just an emphasis that again, these two men who are on the cover photos, there isn't necessarily anything Indian about them other than the fact that they're on the cover of Indians at Work, and there does seem to be an emphasis on phenotype, that they can at least be read as on white, which is problematic, because, of course, American Indian communities have a wide range in appearance, but there really becomes then almost a consolidated idea of what an Indian needs to look like to be read as. But you still... I'm sorry? You know, I didn't write, yes, they do have their names. I don't know, this gentleman, I'm not sure his name. They are there, I didn't write them down. But they are identified within the periodical, they are given, yeah, they identify who they are and where they're from. But that's an excellent question. I'm focusing on cover photos right now, but photos emerge throughout the entire periodical, and sometimes they're identified and sometimes they're not. It depends on what story accompanies that as well, too. But here is kind of nostalgic. These are what I'm kind of terming these ethnographic ones. So again, what's very interesting is that you see by the 1940s, you either have the young, vibrant, modern Indian in the factory, or you have these kind of throwback nostalgic portrayals. What's also interesting here, this covers especially Chief Yesterday. That is actually his name. I mean, it's not, someone didn't give that to him. That is his name. But I think it was chosen for a very particular reason. But it's talking about how the communities are getting ready to support the war effort. And if you can see the one on the right, Eskimos aid United States war effort. So even these nostalgic ones, they're still trying to bring them in and how these communities also contribute. But there's a real difference. You have young urbanites versus older quote-unquote traditional. So you really see this kind of divide being more brought up. There's also a gendered aspect to this. Oftentimes women are, if they do appear in the cover photos, they are largely men, but if there are women that appear in the cover photos, they also tend to be of this kind of ethnographic pose. Now that is not the same as what happens inside the periodical, but at least on the outside, older tribal members and women get put in a certain sort of category, whereas younger men get put into another one. The cover images and the other photographs in Indians at Work also reinforce and in some times kind of reinterpret the American Indian as the embodiment of the warrior ethos. There is a tremendous amount of scholarship concerning the use and appropriation of the image of the American Indian warrior throughout U.S. history. In my intention, I'm not going to go through this well-known path, but rather look at how Indians at Work furthered the use and promotion of this image and how that image expanded to incorporate an urban, industrialized, and fully modern individual. So here's another example of a cover photo, January 1942, the first Americans rise again to defend to defend the homeland. So, of course, an invocation primarily of American Indian participation in World War I, but actually, you know, continued American Indian participation in many conflicts throughout the course of U.S. history. But again, we have very young men now as warriors. I mean, this is a more relaxed pose. I'll show you another one very soon. But again, kind of a reinterpretation in some ways of the warrior image. In the March 1942 issue of Indians at Work, the anthropologist and author Oliver Lafarge wrote a lengthy essay entitled Between the Two Wars, Indians Have Gone Far Forward. And in it, he recounted a trip to the Santa Clara Pueblo where he delivered the news about the attack on Pearl Harbor. Lafarge reported, quote, "There was a general acceptance of the war as their own, deriving from a definite feeling that they were sharers in America and democracy. Several of their boys had been drafted. One was an aviation cadet. Now many more would be needed. An older woman remarked calmly and almost musingly that the girls had better get ready. Nowadays, there were lots of things for women to do to help in a war, and they should expect to be asked to get to work," end quote. And I pulled out that quote for a few very important sorts of things. So it's, again, this reinvocation of American Indian participation in military conflicts, the long history of it. But yet there's a different interpretation in Indians at Work, and that is this notion of work, that American Indians, unlike before when they were just fighters, they are now going to be fighters and workers. And it's going to expand beyond the young men and include the communities as a whole. Lafarge goes on to comment on the differences between those tribal members who served in World War I and those who were going to serve in World War II. He writes, quote, "In every aspect of civilian life, the American Indians have far greater contribution to make to the common effort. Tribes, which dragged out the last war and the many years thereafter in dull, aimless idleness, living and fading away on a thin trickle of relief, today are, quote, taking care of themselves and helping to supply the nation." So what we have, again, and this is kind of an invocation of the works projects itself, so that in between World War I, when people were returned and were dissolute, the works projects came through, they educated them, they got them out, they transformed the landscape, they transformed the nation, and so doing, transformed themselves. So they are now ready to engage on a much bigger level than they had before. We don't just need them for their fighting, but we need them for their work and their bodies, too. So this is a real big difference that the periodical kind of is shaping. And it's a way of them also reinforcing the importance of the works projects, but it really is about the transformation of the American Indian individual. So the idea that the warriors not only triumph on the battlefield, but also on the home front, is supported by the many photographs throughout the issues that highlight work in the war industries as well as service in the armed forces domestically. And I skipped over this. I love this photo. There's lots say about this, but this is the modern warrior. And these men, this comes not from a cover photo, but from inside of a particular issue. But you can see that these men are named Jesse McNevins, who's Cherokee, Tommy Hattenstee, I think is Choctaw, and then Douglas Burris, Chickasaw. And this is a very, so you see a lot of these militaristic, there's a lot of shots of, again, American Indian, primarily men, in kind of these what I would call warrior poses, certainly in uniform, oftentimes engaged, it looks like, in battle. This one is very evocative, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, largely, yes. They were not separated. But this image itself is particularly interesting to me because you are staring down the barrel of the gun, and they are American Indian, again, phenotypically so, because they are soldiers. They are U.S. soldiers, and again, by the prominence of the holsters with the U.S. kind of emblazoned on it, they are primarily and foremost U.S. soldiers. And in some ways, that's why you can trust these Indians with guns who are staring down the barrel of it. But you see a lot of these images kind of go again and again in Indians at Work. But in addition to these kind of what I would call warrior poses, you also have lots of documentation of American Indians engaged in war efforts, some in uniform, and these are just, there's just replete. By the time you hit 1942, almost all of the issues are just replete with these sorts of photographs. And these are very interesting, again, too, people engaged in multiple aspects, not just as warriors, but rather, you know, fully engaged in the war effort. Again, you see men working in the wartime industries. There's a radio operator. You've got people who are registering for service. And then importantly here too, and I just want to bring attention to the subtitle, a modern young Indian. Lydia Snyder is an Indian Service employee at Wind River. Wind River, so she's most likely Arapaho in Wind River, Wyoming. But so again, these images that are very much, I think, shaped to that there's a particular type of Indian, the young Indian. This one does actually include a woman, but she's young, she's modern, she's engaged in this type of work as opposed to older types that might be engaged in other sorts of things, you know, basketry or what have you. So she's a radio operator. She is fully modern. The periodical is invested in demonstrating. So the idea that the warriors not only triumph in the battlefield, the periodical is invested in demonstrating a particular type of warrior image. These are trained, skilled workers that has been transformed through their participation with relief programs. The natural skills, and I, just for interest of time, took out some quotations, but there's a lot of reference to kind of the natural inclination of American Indians to be warriors. It's not hard to get them in uniform because that's where they want to be anyway. They want to be warriors. And there's a lot of discourse surrounding that. But what we see then again, what Indians at Work is trying to say, is that the natural skills have been allied with acquired skills, creating something that is even more powerful and even more evocative of the United States. So you've now got the American Indian who's working in their full capacity to aid the United States. In this narrative, the American Indian, who's already predisposed to be a successful fighter, is transformed through the dominant assimilative narrative of the United States to become a particular type of worker who is ultimately more effective and more potent than the prior incarnation. And then this is my last image, and I'd be happy to take any sort of questions because I know I also went through that fairly quickly. This is probably my favorite photograph. I don't know why. Well, I have two favorite photographs. Okay. But I love this photograph. So this, to me, is kind of the epitome. Here we have a young man who is in a very modernist sort of, and I'm going to look at Laura. I'm lacking the vocabulary of the art historians to be able to talk, but it's a very modern photograph. Not just the content of it, but the photograph itself, in terms of the lines. It's a very kind of futuristic, almost, image itself. But here is clearly a young Indian man who is helping the war effort, not as a warrior, but as a mechanic and kind of the large scale. He is completely detribalized. There's no indication. I mean, it does say he is Kiowa. Because the label tells him it's Kiowa, Wichita, but there's nothing in the image itself that would suggest where he's from. All you know is that he is Indian, engaged in the productive forces of the war industry. And so it's kind of the complete assimilation of Native American communities. They have been brought in, they have been trained, and they are now supporting of the collective kind of U.S. Ideas. So I'm going to kind of end with that one. So the paper has been an introductory view into the ways in which the Office of Indian Affairs both shaped and managed the contributions of American Indians to the war effort and through the works projects. Through Indians at Work, it found a venue to both invoke and reinvent the idea of the American Indian warrior for a new era in technologized warfare. In this instance, he is lethal and thoroughly modern. And while my analysis is decidedly incomplete, I want to end by arguing that my preliminary readings of Indians at Work eliminates a critical and understudied component of the New Deal era. This periodical, while highly edited and mediated, is a critical space in which divergent voices also meet. And I don't have time to talk about that today, but the flip side to what I've been talking about is that there are a lot of American Indian individuals who contributed to Indians at Work as well, tribal members. And a lot of what they supply are not photographs, but they supply text, they supply letters. There was letters to the editor, there was a mailbag. And within this space, they start to both deconstruct and contest this image of the modern Indian, or questioning what it is to be the modern Indian. Collier's influence on the periodical cannot be understated, but the voices from the communities cannot be ignored either. The connection of the periodical to other components of the Office of Indian Affairs and the Works Project Administration is also significant. It's a complicated space where contradictory ideas are articulated and debated, and it's specifically because of this chaotic nature that it demands further attention. So I'm going to end my formal talk there and see if there's any questions. And I do want to go back, though, just to my very, as I said, this is probably one of my most favorite photographs, again, for reasons I can't quite articulate why, but it just seems to state so much. But my other favorite is the one that I actually had in the very beginning, where this is a young Ojibwe girl from Minnesota. I think she's from Red Lake. And the caption within the periodical is that her family was on a rice, they were out ricing. And so you can see her in her cradle board. So she's strapped up into her cradle board while her family is ricing. And of course, she was given an issue of Indians at Work to teeth on, which I think is just, it's beautiful. because it references both the fact that the periodical was supposed to be for the consumption, literally, of American Indian communities and for American Indian communities. And if some ways this photograph to me is the response to that last one that I saw, where you have this very constructed placement of a young American Indian male in this particular way. Here we've got a young American Indian female almost deconstructing it, being in her more traditional sort of array, still at work, but gnawing on this. And I think that it's interesting too, and I don't know enough. This is one photograph that I'm trying to do some research on, is to see how it was staged and who did it and all that sort of stuff. Because the fact that she's gnawing on an issue of Indians at Work with this also photograph that is easily recognizable as an Indian cowboy is also, there's many layers of meaning that can be kind of pulled out of that. So that, you know, a lot of the work of Indians then became as cowboys, and then she's kind of consuming that too. Oh, yep, sorry. Thank you.
And then please do sign in. Just keep those little things circulating if you haven't. And at this time, Bill, jump in.
Oh. Okay, we have this publication which apparently ceases in 1945. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, excellent question, and I'll try and answer. There is something that I would actually kind of claim that I didn't claim here, that this focus of 45 and of bringing these individuals into the war effort, the collective war effort, into urban centers, this is also foreshadowing termination. That is then the policy in the 1950s. In the post-war environment, the policy toward American communities was towards termination of tribal tribes as a whole. And this was both termination, so that tribes themselves would cease to exist, and that individuals would be and then relocated to urban centers, Denver, Minneapolis, Chicago. So these images in some ways are also a little bit of a foreshadowing of actually the termination policy that does follow the conclusion of World War II. Then you've got both the 1960s and 70s with both the return of those individuals to reservation communities. You have people living out most of their adult lives in urban centers, retire or to work. You have young people. You've got the rise of red power. So this discussion, this debate, circulating, and again a reinvention in some ways of what it means to be fully engaged in kind of the common, or you know, in the larger American landscape. But your question is it's a good one, because these debates continue to go on, which, especially for American Indian communities, wanting very much to retain distinctiveness. There is, you know, the tribal lands, tribal rights, tribal treaties that need to be retained, but at the same time saying we can maintain those but still see us as fully engaged in the larger sort of work of American society too. And I say that tension still is actually existing There's a larger story that it kind of goes on, but we don't have a periodical that documents it so elegantly in some ways as Indians at Work does. But I'd say that a lot of the same tensions, they still exist. Mm-hmm. Yep. 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 And the Menominees were the very first under that they were terminated under the termination policies, and then yes, reinstated. But yes, the Menominees were the very first to be. And so a lot, and that again, kind of thinking about why Indians at Work is an important resource, is that it really does kind of it both foreshadows and kind of documents in some ways how we get to termination policy too. Oh, sure.
But I can't help but say that when I see three Native Americans who are featured as soldiers and underneath it says rise again and defend the homeland, do they realize how ironic they were being?
Yes.
Were they being ironic on purpose?
No. Yeah. wait, who was being ironic? The men?
I mean, the whole notion of
no. Yeah, well, that caption to rise again in defense of the homeland was actually done by the Indian office. So they're the ones who put that caption on it. I don't think the men themselves who are in the photo know that. But no, but they're making specific reference to World War I, where American Indian participation was so. And this is true. American Indian it's absolutely undisputable that that American Indian participation in terms of percentage-wise was far larger than any other community in the United States. And in World War I, it was especially more poignant. There were more people who American Indian people who enlisted in the war effort and that weren't even citizens. And actually, I'll kind of then bring you back to the Wanamaker exhibit, which is downstairs. Susan Krause, of course, her book was about American Indian participation in World War I and the documentation of some of those people through the Wanamaker exhibits as well. And it's especially interesting because American Indians were not granted citizenship until the 1920s after their participation in World War I. But yet people certainly, they participated. And there is no sense of irony. That's perhaps the most ironic thing of it. There is no irony at all on the part of the Indian office, their narrative is that even if you even think about 19th century, it wasn't U.S. versus Indians. It was that American Indian communities, tribal communities throughout the nation, had different allegiances, and there were oftentimes, you know, we have the famed Indian Scouts. We've got, you know, so it is done without the least bit of irony. And this goes into the larger warrior, and there has been a lot of stuff that's been written on that, kind of the emergence of the warrior image of the late 19th century, this strange twist that it is at the conclusion of kind of especially the conflicts on the northern plains, where you have American Indian communities being confined to reservations, but at that very same time, the idea of the American warrior, primarily Siouan, like the Lakota warrior, becomes then emblematic of the U.S. as a whole and of their potency as a fighting force. And it's an incredible, I mean, we can look at it as incredible irony, but at the time it was taken very, very sincerely, very seriously. Oh, Collier, sorry, yes. So John Collier. John Collier himself kind of got his rise, or he was very involved with Indian activism in the 1920s, in the early 1920s. He worked with Mabel Dodge Lujan and other people who were interested in Indian reform. He himself was not Native, but became very interested, particularly in the U.S. Southwest, particularly among the Pueblo communities, about land rights issues, and became very important with actually kind of arguing and changing some legislation for the Pueblo communities. He becomes commissioner. He was appointed commissioner, I guess approved by the Senate, but appointed as commissioner by, nominated, that's the term, right? He can't be appointed. He's nominated by Roosevelt to become the Commissioner of Indian Affairs in 1933, and then instituted just huge reforms in terms of political, economic, and then also educational and so forth. He There's a lot written on Collier. If you look at, if you're interested in kind of American Indian, the Indian Reorganization Act and so forth, there's a number of very good works that are done particularly on Collier. And he wrote his own autobiography. It's called From Every Zenith, where he talks a lot about it. But he's a very, there's a lot of kind of contentious scholarship around Collier. He had a very, he was very much interested in American Indian communities maintaining their tribal distinctiveness, which was a clear change and a radical change from all of before. This was after the Dawes Act, after a lot that had been trying to really kind of assimilate, that all of the policy towards American Indian communities had been assimilated, that they need to become part of the larger American populace. Collier was saying, no, they need to remain distinctive. This is important. We as a country lose if we lose the distinctiveness of American Indian communities and cultures. And so he was very very involved in arts projects and so forth. And so he marks a radical change in the 1930s about American Indian policy. However, looking back on it, and there's been kind of a rethinking Collier and his impact, he was also himself very much influenced by kind of nostalgic notions of what it meant to be tribal members. And a lot of the policies that he based upon kind of his model of the American Indian, which was a Pueblo culture that, you know, ruled mostly by theocracies, where there was a real tight kind of political governance and religious and cultural governance. And he kind of tried to apply that to other communities, and it was a little bit more of an imperfect fit. And he was a real curious guy. He had these very nostalgic notions about American Indian communities, but he really believed in the social science and how social science could reform everything. And that if you just kind of studied something in the right sort of way, you could come up with an agreeable policy to all. Let's see, I'm not quite sure where else to go with Collier, but he's a...
When did he leave his
office? 45. He actually, so this...
this is more or less contemporaneous with the FDR...
Yes. Yes. He is. Yep, he is. He is totally, he is very much a product of, I mean, yeah, he's very much emblematic of Roosevelt's administration and the policies and progressive policies and liberal policies that Roosevelt expounded. Collier, when he left office, was left in somewhat defeat. There's no question American Indian communities right now are still governed by a lot of the things that he instituted under the Indian Reorganization Act. His impact cannot be ignored. I mean, it's huge. But then right after his leaving office, there was a huge just sweeping out of everything that he did and the implementation of what I've been talking about with the termination policy, where it was a full pendulum swing from tribal autonomy and self-governance to we're going to just terminate tribal structures as a whole by the government. So.
Other questions?
Yeah, Laura. They are. So this is where I need to start. I mean, I've been working with the periodical, and I need to go do actual archival research in the National Archives has most of the materials for Indians that work in the CCC. It's in Records Group 75, but there's this particular. They are not. Most of the photographs largely are not attributed to any photographer. Sometimes they talk about them being reprinted, and there are a lot of reprints. And so if they're reprinted from a monograph, they'll give the source material. Some of them, and I actually shouldn't have because it would have been a great... Some Parade magazine. They print things like from Parade. So these are big commercial photographers. There's a large amount that are kind of big photographers, then just I think kind of some smaller ones too. I've only just started to look, and since I don't know the history of American photography, which I really need to talk to you about, there are just a few identified people who were part of the big, because of course the Federal Project and the photographers that were associated with that. From what there are a few of those names that sometimes crop up, but not to any huge extent. But there are some of those photographers are also contributing.
Many other really enjoyed the talk, and it makes me think that in your
Okay, I didn't know.
A scholar there who was doing it, and it's focusing on iron workers and steel workers, and this is moving beyond the Mohawk of
right.
The city that worked in
New York. Absolutely. Actually, that's a really great. I did know about America Works, but I didn't know the project that's happening in Wisconsin. So that's thank you for that. Yeah. Oh wow. Wow. Thank you for that, because I will look up at that too. Yeah, and it is interesting, and it's one of the things that there is a lot of traffic in. So Chantel Norgo, a pre-doc here a few years ago, working on kind of labor and labor history among Ojibwe people, both in Wisconsin and in Minnesota, and she used it, a lot of her sources are actually WPA materials as well, and she looks at a lot of the and there's so much documentation projects that are going on about kind of berries, uses of berries and ricing, and so she's looking at this collection but looking at it as work. And what's interesting, so there's all, and that's back to kind of how I was framing this in the beginning. There is so much stuff out there, but there's no nexus for kind of putting it all together. And I guess that's one of the things that I'm arguing is that Indians at Work actually is a place to kind of put some of this stuff together. So there is just so much, and I'm glad to hear that that's actually happening. So I'll actually follow up on that. That's a really good suggestion.